Welcome to the panel, RNZ National Friday's show. Wallace Chapman with you. A lot of response regarding alcoholic choices, non-alcoholic choices, but Joni says, I totally agree regarding terrible non-alc choices. I'm not a teenager and I don't want to drink Coke or Fanta. New Zealand has beautiful choices like Fijoa, but they are not offered. And Regan says, here's one, tonic water and cascara, which is coffee cherry skin tea, ice blocks with an orange slice, tart, effervescent and refreshing. We've had quite a few recipes come through. I might give you a few later on in the program. And quite a bit regarding Latin and Latin being dropped classics. Marie says, I studied Greek and Latin for some years at high school. I went to study anatomy, physiology and a small amount of pathology. Nearly every word is based on Latin or Greek, and it's easy to learn those subjects when you understand the meaning of the word. Today I'm with, for the first time on the panel, Amy Adams, former National Party Minister, and Sam Johnson, Chief Executive of the Student Army Foundation and Social Entrepreneur, both in our Christchurch studio. First on the program today, a research project led by researchers at Te Heranga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, has shown the potential impact that use of facial recognition technology, or FRT, has on human rights. And the research shows that FRT is increasing in usage in Aotearoa and comparable countries, and used across sectors, government departments, policing, banking, travel, security and customer tracking. And it highlights the current regulation gap in New Zealand, with Associate Professor Nessa Lynch, the lead author, saying that if the gap is unplugged soon, the impact on human rights like privacy, like freedom of expression, etc., are potentially extensive. So are we entering a new era in mass surveillance? With us is Dr. Andrew Chen, a research fellow with COIT2, the Centre for Informed Futures at Auckland University, whose PhD research focused on the use of camera-based person tracking. Dr. Chen, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Look, on first reading here, what did you make of this report, Dr. Chen?
Yeah, I think it's a really good report that highlights a lot of applications of facial recognition technology that many people may not have been aware of. So it focuses a lot on police, but there are also broader government and also commercial uses of facial recognition technology that are here and with us today. I think one of the things that it does is it demonstrates that facial recognition is a biometric technology that can be done at a distance without people necessarily knowing. So it is similar to, say, DNA or fingerprints in that it's biometric, but your image can be captured from quite a distance using a camera, and you may not know that facial recognition technology is being used to process your image.
I wanted to ask a question, and please don't mind me if it's a silly question, but look, where do the source images come from? Are they collected with people's consent? Do they come from webcam images from a street? Where do they come from?
Yeah, so it depends on the application and the use. And there are a lot of CCTV cameras around, and sometimes those are the sources of images. If you're matching against the database, then, for example, you might have access to driver's license photos, or you might have passport photos. And those might be the sources that you use.
Gosh, so that's allowed. People can harvest images of people in a public street view, and maybe, as you say, there's a lot of private company applications for this. They can be used for those companies?
There are restrictions around how you do that. So we saw with Clearview, for example, earlier or at the beginning of this year, they were harvesting images of people on social media, so on Facebook and Twitter, and from newspapers as well. And that was actually in breach of the terms and conditions or the terms of service of many of those providers. And so that was actually probably illegal, but they went ahead and did it anyway.
Right. I'll come to our panel soon, Andrew, but look, a couple of issues here. Scotland, because there are some recommendations, aren't there, here, including giving biometric information like DNA, fingerprints, iris scans, facial data, special protection. So you see Scotland setting up a biometrics commissioner as a watchdog. Do you think something similar could well be useful in New Zealand or should happen in New Zealand?
Yeah, I think that there should be some form of oversight. I think it's important to say that a lot of this biometric information is actually quite useful and can be used for legitimate and positive purposes. And what we're really saying here is just that we have to be careful about where we draw the lines and making sure that everybody knows where those lines are and that those lines are followed.
All right.
So having a biometrics commissioner is a good idea as one way of making sure that those lines are being followed.
Okay, Amy Evans, what's your thoughts or questions here?
Yeah, look, I think this is a serious issue for New Zealand. I really worry that we don't have a decent understanding and, I guess, public agreement about when we can use things like facial recognition software, all sorts of biometric tracking. I mean, this is the new face of privacy. I remember looking at this when I was the Justice Minister, and the reality is we can't rely on people's names and dates of birth as ID. Going through the court system, you know, there's been many situations where names have seen people released when they shouldn't or wrongly charged and mistaken ID. So biometrics has to be the way to go, but it has to be used carefully and with an agreed framework. And right now, our law is lagging behind technology, and we do need to have a serious public discussion and get some robust rules in place.
Okay, so you think that some sort of regulatory framework is missing. You agree with the conclusions in the report?
Yeah, look, I do. And I think it's just one of those things where technology is moving far faster than our legal systems. And I don't think we should be afraid of using it. I think there will have to be a place for the use of biometric information by our law enforcement agencies. But what I don't want to see is the police charging off and doing it now because they can without that in place. So I think we do have to take a pause, get those systems in place and then use it properly rather than, as I say, let agencies just jump in without oversight.
Sam and Jonathan, do you have a comment or a question for
Amy? I agree with what Amy said, actually. I mean, a couple of the recommendations in the report that I was drawn to, one of them, the number one was a new category of personal information for biometric information, so that makes sense. Number six was transparency and usage, which makes sense. But I had a question over number nine, which called for an immediate moratorium by police on using it. And that I did wonder if that's actually, you know, would that actually prevent crimes being solved by facial recognition technology now? So that was the one I didn't sort of wondered how that goes, but okay. I mean, Amy would know more than me.
Well, I mean, we use biometric information now, of course, with, you know, some retinal scanning work, but certainly fingerprints. And anyone who, well, not that we do it now, but anyone who's flown through the States in recent years will know you can't get through the border over there without putting your handprint on the scanning machine and your retina up to the scanning machine. So these things are already pretty commonplace around the world. But I do think, you know, as I say, rather than just sort of leap into the next frontier and people being photographed up and down the street and used for what, you know, for whatever purpose, we need to understand how it's being used, where it's okay and where it's not okay.
Yeah, well, I'm just looking at some of the research here. I mean, an article in Nature, Andrew, cited, you know, this controversial New York City-based tech company Clearview AI, which says it scraped 3 billion online photos for the facial recognition system, has been sued. Clearview says it searches only publicly available information like Google or any other search engine. Clearly, for punters listening to this, or really any citizen, there's got to be some concerns.
Yeah, so sort of two points. Firstly, just in response to that, in terms of Clearview, New Zealanders thankfully probably don't have too much to worry about. Yeah. So New Zealand police tried it in New Zealand very, very briefly earlier in the year and found that it basically didn't work for our context. So we can worry, we can breathe easily, a little bit more easily about Clearview. Just to come back to that question about the moratorium,
yeah.
I think... To New Zealand police's credit, they have not used this technology as much as some of the other jurisdictions around the world. They've been a little bit more cautious, and I think they recognize that facial recognition is a high-risk, controversial topic that they shouldn't just sort of dive into. At the same time, we can't just rely on police sort of feeling like that maybe this is controversial, maybe they shouldn't use it. There needs to be that regulatory framework that Amy was talking about in the background to create the rules that govern how police might use this. And this idea about having a moratorium is essentially saying, well, police are telling us that they don't use this technology on live footage. They'll only use it on recorded footage, or they might be saying, oh, we've got a photo of somebody and we need to go search the database to find out who they might be. But they're not using it on live CCTV footage.
Sam?
So if police are saying they're not doing this, then they might as well say, we won't do this for another 5 years. Or we won't use it for another 10 years. And that would give all of us quite a bit more confidence that police aren't just going to suddenly turn on this technology tomorrow.
Yeah, I think another issue in here that is also about just the governance of how information that is collected is stored. So whether it's a company or government, is our cybersecurity governance strong enough? I don't think it is. Australia, I think, is bringing in a duty on directors around their obligations for protecting systems. But I think there's a ways to go there, and you'd want to make some pretty substantial changes there and ensure that if you are collecting this information, that it is actually kept secure and it can't be hacked. And the simplest thing to do is two-step authentication on emails, I believe. And I don't think that's widespread across the country. And I think we have a bit of work to do there just to protect the information we have.
Right. Hey, just finally, Dr. Chin, I mean, is this an issue that's really at the forefront internationally? I mean, keeping an eye on what's been happening in Hong Kong and facial recognition technology with the police there. And the comeback on that, it's been a really big issue, hasn't it?
Absolutely. This is a hot topic in a lot of places. You've got several US states and cities that have banned the use of facial recognition by government agencies. At the same time, you've got places like the UK that are just going full hog into using facial recognition as much as they can, or places like China and Hong Kong. So this is something that's playing out on a global stage, and we need to be aware of how that's going to affect us here in New Zealand.
Yeah, and can we learn from those examples and actually sort of be a bit more cautious?
Oh, absolutely. And there are some good examples of places like Scotland that have put in rules around how you might use or not use facial recognition technology.
All right, Dr. Andrew Chin there. Thank you very much for that. Just on a personal level, Amy, do you have any concerns, or you're not worried at all of streetscapes being utterly canvassed by facial recognition cameras?
Look, I do have concerns. I think, as I said, I think, you know, we have to accept that privacy is an evolving thing and the way the world works changes. But I think New Zealanders want to know whether when they're going about their ordinary business somewhere it's being captured and read and downloaded and, as Sam says, stored somewhere that we don't know about. So I'm not a we should never do this, it's evil, keep it away from us. But I just think if we're going to go into it, it has to be, and if you excuse the pun, eyes open as to where and when and how it's used and where it's stored. And until that's sort of a common understanding and we've had that discussion, then we need to be a bit cautious.
Okay. 19 past four, Amy Adams and Sam Johnson with me on the panel. Actually, a lot of response regarding non-alcoholic. Obviously, it's resonated.
It's a hot topic, I tell you. There's a vein of outrage out there.
Well, Fiona says, I totally agree with Amy. Look, I just had this experience in Auckland on Saturday night. I couldn't find non-alc. Now that we have 0% beer, surely it's a no-brainer to have it on offer at bars and restaurants. Drink all night, go home sober. And regarding, I've got to sort of mention this, I have been sent a wonderful image of a person who is so into his Latin that he has a Latin tattoo on his hand. I'm a Kiwi and PhD from Australian National University. I speak Latin every day to explain my tattoo, which is SPQR, the People and Senate of Rome. I'm half Italian, and this tattoo is my Ta Mōkel. Thank you for that. Text us 2101 with your feedback. Now, the Spanish government is considering a proposal to subsidise companies to introduce a four-day week without a cut in pay. The plan, which would begin as a small pilot, is currently being considered by the Spanish Treasury after it was floated by the small left-wing party there. Maspies, is that how you pronounce it? Anyway, the global corporation Unilever is trialling a four-day week with its employees in New Zealand. As part of a one-year trial, employees will be paid for 5 days while working for 4 days a week. If successful, the model could be rolled out to the company's 165,000 workers globally. So there's quite a bit riding on that trial. With us is Charlotte Lockhart, who's the co-founder of the 4 Day Week Global Foundation. Charlotte, kia ora.
Kia ora.
So obviously you are a supporter of the 4 Day Week, but look, of course, not all jobs are suited to a 4 Day Week perhaps, but do you think this idea as a rule is becoming more popular?
Oh, it most certainly is. If you think about it, when we started the four-day week in at Perpetual Guardian 2.5 years ago, no one was having this conversation. And now it's just a conversation around the world. I pretty much work full-time just talking to people about this coaching and supporting businesses with this journey. I mean, we've been working with Unilever since December of last year, taking them on a journey, not just their New Zealand office, but through their global head of HR and working through what that will look like. We've got a number of other multinationals that are looking at it. But on the whole, this is something that lots and lots of thousands of small businesses around the world are doing a four-day week.
Interesting, isn't it, Charlotte, that because RNZ, we'd talk about the four-day week as a rule pre-pandemic, and people would not think, you know, it's a good idea perhaps. But it was really, isn't it amazing how COVID really forced the hand of companies?
Well, it certainly did, because prior to that, we didn't, companies didn't trust their staff enough to let them, work remotely or flexibly, and didn't really understand how they might measure productivity if they just weren't watching them all of the time. And now, of course, COVID, and particularly overseas, I mean, in New Zealand, we've been very lucky with our response here. It has not even remotely impacted on us in the way it has done in the US and Europe and around the world. But so they are all scrambling to find a new way of working and how they layer the trust that they have developed with their staff on what that new work will be. Having said that, there is a lot of overwork that's being done. And there's a new phrase that we're that's sort of really been coined, where we're talking about people, they're not working from home, they're sleeping at work.
Wow. I remember that one. Amy Adams, what do you got to say for this?
Yeah, I had a good chat with Charlotte about the four-day work week a few months back, actually, and I think it's a really interesting idea. And I think what's important is we're not talking about people going to part-time. We're still talking about full-time jobs, full-time responsibilities, but we're doing our full week of work in 4 days. And I've often thought I'd much rather be at work 4 days, work really efficiently and power through it, and then have three, clear days. And I think what Perpetual Guardian did and Charlotte's been talking about just proves how effective it can be. I'd much rather get in, get my work done, smash it out, and then have a bit more life. I burnt out, I'm happy to admit, in politics, and there's nothing worse than just driving yourself into the ground and burning out.
Gosh, just
let people have a bit of life.
Amy, just on that, from a purely personal level, a four-day week, you really support it from that angle?
Look, I do. I think we have to find ways to have a bit more life in our lives. I've come out of a couple of pretty intense careers, and there's nothing wrong with working hard, but you do need to find time with family, for your health, for your kids, for the community. And if you can get your whole week's work done in those 4 days, which we know can be done, then why not? I think it's a win for the employer, it's a win for the employee, and I think basically we'd have a happier, more content society as a result.
Sam, a comment for Charlotte?
It caused a good debate within our office today when I said I was coming on the panel discussing this, and the team, of course, quick as a flash, said, "Right, we'll do 4 day work week." But as a small business owner, running a little charity, I was like, "Oh, what will that mean for me? Is that will we get through the work? What how does it go?" So I guess it comes down to productivity. So my question, Charlotte, is it shown that that will help us catch up in terms of productivity as a country?
Absolutely. And actually, we're working with a couple of New Zealand offices of large international charities. So, Sam, we will take this conversation further offline.
Oh, no.
Or message me on Facebook. This is a conversation about productivity. And slight point of order, Mr. Speaker, we're not necessarily talking about a four-day week. We're talking about reducing the number of hours we work. And so you have to be very careful. We're not talking about extended long days. And some businesses cannot close their doors for a whole day. In fact, at Perpetual Guardian, we couldn't. We said, look, we're going to run this trial. And we actually have a reduced hour working model now. We continue with 4 day week because people understand what that is. But in reality, having a whole day off doesn't necessarily suit all people. What we're talking about is you having the right sort of time off that suits your life, but also suits your responsibilities within the business, your productivity needs that you put out there. And I have a great phrase, and Amy, you're welcome to use it whenever you like, because I think it's fantastic. when you're talking about working too hard and burning out. I use this phrase all the time. We need to remember that we borrow our people from their lives.
That's a good one.
And when you think of it like that, you actually realise that, you know, life out of work, we're allowed to have life outside of work.
Yeah.
And actually you work better if you do have life outside of work. You know, if you're coming to work rested and well-slept and feeling balanced, you get more done. And if I remember rightly, Charlotte, I think you pointed out to me in our last conversation that not only were people, you know, got all their productivity done in a shorter time frame, they're actually more productive. So you end up as an employer getting effectively more out of them than they would over the original 40-hour week. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Internationally, businesses report between 20% and 30% productivity uptick. I mean, I was speaking with a company that's in Glasgow. They've got offices throughout Europe, but they've been doing it since 2016. Wow. Initially, they had over a 30% uptick, but sustainably, nearly 5 years later, they have a 21.9% uptick.
Is that large and small businesses, Charlotte?
Large and small. I mean, Microsoft Japan had 39.9% when they did it. But most small businesses, it depends also what you're measuring, Sam. Mm. Sometimes it's a very specific, qualitative thing. But for a lot of businesses, what you're measuring is quantitative. You're looking at how does work feel. Introducing the four-day week into our business at Perpetual Guardian was the best team-building exercise we ever did. And that's what people find universally, because you're asking your team to come up with all the solutions and to support and help you with how that is. And so it's a team thing.
Charlotte, I've got a couple of... listen, though. Paul says, Wallace, I'm a builder. It's not physically possible for me to do 4 days work in 5 days. Nice idea for desk jockeys.
Well, it is a nice idea for desk jockeys, but there's actually people doing four-day week in construction and all sorts of things all around the world. It just depends on how you structure your business and what you're doing. Now, working as a builder is, introducing a four-day week into your business would be complicated. It's complicated for farming. It's complicated for schools and medicine. It's not impossible, and it depends on the outcome that you're trying to achieve and how you achieve it.
Nice to have you on the program, Charlotte. Thank you very much. Charlotte Lockhart there, co-founder of the 4 Day Week Global Foundation. After the headlines, we're going to be talking about Latin and classics. What do you support dropping them, or do you support keeping them? What do you think? Should they stay or go? 2101 is the number to text. Just a bit on our Friday mailbag here. Non-alcoholic. Recipe for a great non-alcoholic beverage. Take one glass, either highball or tumbler, go to the cold tap, turn on film glass desired level.
It's nice if it comes in a little bottle or something, isn't it?
Yeah, slice of lemon, get really ritzy.
Another one, G&T, half a grapefruit squeezed and poured over ice with tonic, add a mint leaf. The timing of the fruit crop makes it more of a spring drink, though. Wallace, I'm a youngish person who doesn't drink and also works part-time at a supermarket. I'd just say that from my experience, alcohol-free beverages that taste like alcohol don't tend to be too popular with the younger customers and are mostly purchased by the middle-aged or older, which is to say that the market for these... I'm just reading...
I'll wear that title with pride.
I'm just reading it out as it stands, which is to say that the market for these beverages may be quite small with limited growth potential, so who knows? Anyway, thank you for that. It is the panel. We have former National Minister Amy Adams and the Chief Executive of the Student Volunteer Army, Sam Johnson, on with me this afternoon. It's time for headlines.